Chesney from Boston University, here to tell us about higher viral modules, co-invariance, and factorization algebras.
Okay, so thanks a lot for giving me a chance to speak here and for coming to the talk. This is kind of a very preliminary report on some joint work with
the green light's on.
Okay. Is this better? Okay, so just to repeat, this is a preliminary report on some joint work with Owen Gwilliam and Brian Williams, where we, endeavor to study covariance and conformal blocks beyond dimension one and see what shows up, primarily for holomorphic field theories, but also, this is a very kind of generic construction, and so it has, you can do this kind of in the EN algebra or kind of locally constant factorization algebra setting as well. My plan is to just to kind of review the thing that we're trying to generalize. Review how one constructs these spaces of co-invariance in dimension one. So this corresponds to sort of conformal field theory. In dimension one, complex dimension one. And then move to higher dimensions of the language of factorization algebras. Factorization algebra story. Okay, and then if I have time, maybe discuss some examples and kind of further directions. Okay. Do people usually write on the back here or just move to the right?
You're free to use.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about the one-dimensional story. And so the way I'll do this, I'll discuss this kind of in the language of vertex algebras. Part of why I find factorization algebras interesting is that, this is a formalism that works in any number of dimensions, whereas the vertex algebra story is very much tied to kind of one complex dimension. So this is sort of basically following the book of Franco Menzvi on vertex algebras and algebraic curves. So what's the setup here? What are the ingredients in defining the space of co-invariance or conformal blocks? So we have a smooth projective curve with some points on it. Okay, and what we're going to need is a vertex algebra and some modules for this vertex algebra. So I'm going to be using kind of a running example throughout, which is the sort of Kazmuti, the universal affine algebra, if you will. And so let me just describe what that is. I'm sure most people here have seen it. So roughly speaking, what's a vertex algebra? Well, it's a vector space equipped with a map from itself to an endomorphism-valued power series in Z and Z inverse, satisfying a number of properties. In particular, the kind of main thing that falls out of this is the notion of an operator product expansion, which sort of describes what happens in physics, what happens when sort of two operators are brought very, very close together. When they approach each other, there is this product, so to speak, develops singularities, and so there's a whole kind of meromorphic calculus attached to this, which is very useful in representation theory, which allows you to kind of compute commutators and do a variety of other things. So what's an example of such a thing? Well, if G is a let's say a semi-simple complex Lie algebra, then we can form from this the affine Kasmoudi algebra, which is we start with the loop algebra of G, and we add a central term. And here the bracket is just given by multiply f and g together, and then the central cocycle is to take the residue at t equals 0 of f dg, okay, times the central term. And so out of this, you can construct a vertex algebra from a certain induced representation. So here the vertex algebra, which I'll denote kind of VKG, is a certain induced module. From the trivial representation, and we're inducing up from kind of the positive loops, where the positive loops act by zero and K acts by some scalar K. And we induce this all the way up to G hat. So you can think of this object as sort of, it's spanned by sort of monomials. If G has a basis, an ordered basis, kind of J1 through JR, then this thing looks like one. Here is a stand-in for what's called the vacuum vector, and here all the ni's are less than or equal to -1. So it's just spanned by sort of a monomials in these loop generators, and this vertex algebra structure is somehow generated in an appropriate sense by just deciding what you're going to assign to each of these factors. So it's enough actually to assign this field, and this is given by this. And more complicated monomials get assigned certain normally ordered products of these fields. Okay. So I've told you what the sort of basic example of a vertex algebra looks like. Now let me talk about modules. So one ingredient was to be a vertex algebra, and now we need modules. So we need and we think of putting these modules at these sort of at each point of this pointed curve. And what are some examples of modules? Well, I just gave you, I just used this kind of induction procedure from the trivial representation to construct the vertex algebra itself, and you can use the same procedure to construct modules for it. So some standard examples of this are what are called Weil modules. And they're very similar to this thing, but except for starting with the trivial representation and inducing up from that, I'm going to start with some finite dimensional representation of G, which is not necessarily trivial. So if N is some representation of G. Just realize that let me use the U here. U is a representation of G. Then W of U. So this is the Weyl module induced from U is defined to be the induced representation from U up to G hat. But now the action of this inducing algebra is not trivial on U. Rather, what I can do is, if I have a positive loop, a loop that's regular at the origin, that has no poles at the origin, I can evaluate it at the origin, and I will get an element of G. And I can use that element of G to act on U, and the central element acts by K. Okay, so this is a type of evaluation representation, if you will, from here, and I will induce it all the way up to G hat. And this is, so since part of the talk is about generalized Weyl modules, I wanted to tell you about this. And that more generally, you can kind of induce from smaller subalgebras. So another thing you can do is to, rather than inducing from G adjoint T, I can induce up from something like T to the N GT, let's say the trivial representation. So this is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, okay? So these are all examples of modules that one could put at these points. And once I've done this, so given these ingredients, we obtain two spaces which are in duality to each other. So one is the space of co-invariance. Let me just say what it is for this particular example, since it's easier to say. So this is attached to a curve, some points, and some modules at those points. And in this particular example, when we're dealing with, and I mean, this is a general feature of all vertex algebras, which are somehow constructed out of Lie algebras, that you can reduce this space to just a space of co-invariance for the generating Lie algebra, so to speak. So this can be written as, I'm going to take co-invariance of the tensor product of M1 up to Mn modulo so let me explain what I mean by this. So a priori, these are representations of this affine vertex algebra, and it will follow from that that these are representations of G hat, of the affine Kasmoudi algebra also. What I need to explain is kind of, so what is this thing? So this thing is, what I do is I take meromorphic, so these are meromorphic functions on the punctured curve. So this, I'm starting with a smooth projective curve, but I remove the points, and now I have an affine curve, and I'm going to take meromorphic functions on that, so things that have, you know, at most finite order poles at the marked points. And if I do that, and let's say for the purpose of this talk, that I also choose a parameter, a coordinate, near each one of these points, so z1 near x1 and z2 near x2 and so on, then I can take this meromorphic function that's g-valued and expand it in a Laurent series around every point. And so I can view that Laurent series as living inside of this loop algebra, and that gives me an element of the Kasmoudi algebra at each point. Okay, this is subject to a choice of parameter at each point, but one can show that this doesn't depend on those choices. So this space is going to be isomorphic regardless of how we choose parameters. And then this thing just acts kind of as it would on a tensor product. So we expand it around each point and act on each module factor. Okay. So from written like this, it's a bit of a sort of strange looking object. And then we define the space of conformal blocks. With the same data. To just be the dual space to the space of covariance. Okay. And why does one do this? Perhaps let me just say a few words. So, conformal blocks. Used to construct correlation functions in conformal field theories. So how does this work? Well, I can take n copies of my curve and on this n copies there is a sheaf whose fiber at each point is a copy of one of these modules. So over here, fiber of MI at some point X is isomorphic to this module MI. So now I have a copy of the module over each point of the curve. And so the space of conformal blocks, this is a space of covariance. It's a quotient of the tensor product of n modules. Whereas the space of conformal blocks, since it's a dual, is actually naturally a subspace in the dual of this tensor product. And therefore, each conformal block gives me a point. So each or a conformal block. Let me call an element in here. Let me just call it, sort of generically label it by the modules F sub F superscript M x1 through xn. Is an element in the fiber of at the point x1 through xn. And now the fact is that the sheaf the sheaf that lives over x to the n has a flat connection. So this is called the KZ connection. And sort of in local coordinates, you can kind of generically, I'm just kind of rushing through this, but what this connection looks like is it looks like D plus L minus 1 tensor DZ, where Z is some local coordinate. And what's L minus 1? L minus 1 is, this is the, this is one of the Virasoro generators. So it turns out that if you have this vertex algebra, then it automatically carries an action of the Virasoro algebra via, this comes from the existence of a stress tensor. And so the Virasoro algebra is a central extension of vector fields on the punctured disk. And in particular, this generator L minus 1 corresponds to the vector field ddz. Okay? And so there's kind of an internal action of vector fields on the vertex algebra, and then combining it with, I mean, you can glue this together into a connection. And this connection is sort of independent of coordinate. It's somehow canonical. So anyway, the point is, this sheaf has a connection, and therefore so does its dual. And so if I pick an element in the fiber of this sheaf, now I have a notion of parallel transport, right? So at least locally, I can extend this one element in the fiber to a horizontal section, and that becomes my correlation function. So of course, this is not necessarily a function. It's some section of some sheaf, and it's not going to be single-valued in general. In fact, its kind of lack of single-valuedness is very interesting, because as you go around diagonals in this product of curves, you get monodromies, and these monodromies are connected with the R matrices of the kind of quantum group corresponding to G. So this is part of a long story where these conformal blocks play an important role. In a slightly different context, conformal blocks can also be identified with spaces of sections of line bundles over moduli spaces. So if instead of working with this vertex algebra, I had chosen one of its cousins, the so-called kind of integrable quotient, and k is a, to make this interesting, k should be a positive integer, then it would have turned out that this space of conformal blocks is isomorphic to the space of non-abelian theta functions over the moduli space of G bundles, or related spaces of over moduli of parabolic bundles and so on, okay? So these, and that's the beginning kind of a nice long story involving the Verlinde formula and so on. So anyway, I hope at least this kind of haphazard discussion has convinced you that these spaces of covariance are and conformal blocks are interesting. Before moving on, I just wanted to mention a simple but kind of turns out to be important result. So about covariance or conformal blocks, this is called the propagation of vacua. And what it says is, so if I go back to my curve here, let's suppose that I have put some collection of modules at each of these xn points, and now I introduce an extra point, which to kind of distinguish it, I'll just call y. And I don't put just any module here, I put the vertex algebra itself. I put V, this thing that was induced up from the vacuum. Then the statement is that these spaces don't change and are canonically isomorphic. So what this says is that so if I introduce an extra copy of this V, which corresponds to the vacuum sector, nothing happens. All right, so let me now move on to the kind of factorization algebra world. Where are the erasers? Oh, sorry. Okay, so that kind of factorization algebra story. So the idea is that we're now going to allow X to have any dimension. For now, let's stick with X being a complex manifold. In fact, to be absolutely certain that everything I say works, let's assume that X is a smooth projective variety. So the idea is to kind of construct in some geometric way construct geometrically kind of modules for so FA will denote factorization algebras analogous to this vertex algebra, which I just discussed. So to make sense of this, I need to tell you what a factorization algebra is approximately, or at least give an example, and suggest what the connection to vertex algebras might be. So these things were developed by Kevin and Owen Williams. So and I mean, there's a sort of a closely related algebra geometric formalism, which is, I think, primarily developed in dimension one by Bailenson and Drinfeld under the name chiral algebra. So there is, generally speaking, some way of translating results from one world to another, but I don't know that anyone's really kind of systematically written down how this is to be done, but in any case, the same objects or related objects appear in several formalisms. So what is a factorization algebra? Factorization algebra on X assigns to each open subset U in X. So let me use curly F for this. An object F of U of some category C, but for us, C will be either chain complexes or just vector space. But it certainly basically makes sense to talk about factorization algebras valued in any sort of symmetric tensor category. And this assignment should have some natural properties. So to each open set, I assign, let's say, a vector space or a chain complex. And the way this should work is, let's just draw a picture. Such that for every inclusion of a disjoint union into some bigger open set V, we should get a structure map from the tensor product of the F of UIs to F of V. Okay. And moreover, these structure maps should be kind of naturally associative. So if I interpose an intermediate open set W here in between these two U's and the ambient V, I should be able to kind of apply the structure map from U1, U2 into W first, and then combine it with U3 into V. So it should be naturally associative. So, and there's some other properties which maybe I'm not going to tell you about, but this is the rough idea. And so if I have such a structure on a manifold X, given X and F, then the global sections of this thing, F of X, so this will be typically a chain complex, right? Or co-chain complex. And this is what we call the kind of factorization homology. And then, of course, we can talk about individual pieces of this. So we can look at pieces of this. And so this is the kind of ith factorization homology. And typically this is my understanding that, this was developed to kind of keep track of or describe the structure of observables in classical and quantum field theories. And these structure maps, we are supposed to think about if we think about X as being space-time, then these maps kind of tell you how to combine measurements in smaller subsets of space-time into larger subsets. It's kind of a local to global object. And in sort of physical situations, one would expect H0 to be the space of kind of global observables of the theory. And then these higher cohomologies. So now I'm confused how this is greater. The other cohomologies have to do with symmetries and higher symmetries and things like that. Okay. So how does one build such an object? One can construct such from a kind of nice sheaf of Lie algebras. So this is what in their book Kevin and Owen call local Lie algebras. And so here are two kind of standard examples. So G, as always, this is still a finite dimensional semi-simple Lie algebra over C. And there are kind of two flavors of things we can do, at least. One of them is going to, I'll denote like this, GX de RAM, which is I'm just going to take G and tensor it with the de RAM complex of X. So this is a sheaf, right? To each open set, I assign G tensor the Durham complex on that open set. And I can do, if X happens to be complex, I can do kind of a Dobeau version of this, which is and these are DGLAs because here I have the Durham differential, and here I have the Dobeau differential. And one can do fancier things. You can add a central extension and so on. But this is kind of the basic structure. And the Lie algebra structure here is simply take the bracket in G and then wedge the form parts together. Okay. And so if let me generically denote one of these types of examples by L. So if L is either 1 or 2, I'll denote by L sub C the compactly supported sections. Of these sheaves, so this is now a co-sheaf, because if I have a compactly supported form, I can extend it by zero to an open, to a larger open set. And so what we get is that if I have a bunch, if I have a disjoint union of sets, then LC of the disjoint union of these open sets is actually, as a Lie algebra, isomorphic to the direct sum of these things. Because if forms have disjoint support, then if I wedge them together, I'm going to get zero. So I really get a Lie algebra summand for each connected open set. And so to get my factorization algebra, I take Chevalier chains. So I send U to Chevalier chains on compactly supported sections of this sheaf over U. And Chevalier chains are going to send direct sums of Lie algebras to tensor products of the corresponding Chevalier complexes. So we get the type of structure now. We've sort of exponentiated the structure, and we get a factorization algebra. OK, so what's the relationship to vertex algebras? If I have a factorization algebra over, so for the, I said at the beginning of this that X was going to be smooth projective, but to say this, I have to allow X to just be the complex numbers. So if X is C, then let me just say that then and kind of nice factorization algebras produce vertex algebras. So if you have a factorization algebra on the complex line, which satisfies some natural conditions, that for instance is translation invariant, and it carries an action of rotations. So C is, of course, acted on by a circle, by rotations. Then you can extract from this data a vertex algebra. And roughly speaking, the vertex algebra that you get corresponding to F is kind of just take H naught of the global sections of C. So I'm lying a bit because you have to cut it down to size slightly. But this is an issue of completion. And so if you do this, more or less, you're going to get a vertex algebra. OK, so now let me talk about modules in this setting. And oh, yeah, I should have said. So, in particular, it's the relationship to the vertex algebra that we saw at the beginning, this affine vacuum module. So if X equals C, and we take GX dobo, so chains, this is our factorization algebra, then roughly speaking, VF is this VKG. So the vertex algebra we would extract from this local Lie algebra construction corresponding to G dobo would recover this this vertex algebra. Okay, so let's talk about modules. So we're back in the setting where X is a smooth projective. And we can essentially make a module out of any closed subscheme of X and a module for the finite dimensional Lie algebra. So I'm going to take Z and X, a closed subscheme, and this thing doesn't have to be reduced. And in fact, a situation where this situation where it is not reduced is kind of interest as well. And M is, again, a representation of the finite dimensional Lie algebra. And now I can do this, I can do the following thing. So this is our generalized Weyl module. So we construct as follows. So I'm looking for, yeah, just white chalk.
There should be some in a little box under this.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to denote this thing by, well, there's some input data here, so let me call it WMZ. So what I do is first, let's resolve the structure sheaf of this closed subscheme Z. So this this is a locally free resolution of OZ. Okay. So I resolve the structure sheaf by vector bundle, and then I can just tensor this with the Dobel complex in M. So my WMZ is going to be, and here actually I might choose to use some arbitrary P, not necessarily zero. So maybe this P should also be included here. Okay. And this is, so this carries an action of this sheaf of Lie algebras, G Dobeau, right? So WMZP is acted on by this Lie algebra, right? So it's a sheaf of modules for this DGLA, and so I can take their semi-direct product. So we can form kind of a square zero extension Lie algebra. So this is just a kind of basic algebraic construction where you start with an algebra and a module and you smash them together. So if I have a bunch of these, MIZIPI. And I need to shift this. I think I want the codimension of Z. So it's minus codim
ZI, but I could be wrong about this. Okay, so this is now, let's just call this, I don't know, GMX for sure, because this notation gets kind of annoying. Okay, so this is again what one of these sort of locally algebras. And so we can take its Chevalier complex and produce a new factorization algebra. So this factorization algebra, you take chains of GMX. I need to take compact support here because otherwise I can't extend by zero. If you think about it, if you think about the Chevalier complex, right, this is just a symmetric algebra on this whole mess. And the bracket on this part is kind of trivial. So I can really, this is exactly the same thing as chains of just the old G dobo X with values in the symmetric algebra on these WMIs. Okay? So this is a giant thing. It's just Chevalier chains of G dobo in the symmetric algebra on all these modules. Now, this thing is kind of, it's a bit too big. Well, it depends on taste. But so I'm going to just look at a certain piece of it. A name. FM. Okay, so FM. Is multigraded. Each factor of MI, or of WMI, is assigned degree. So if I have n modules, I'm going to grade by kind of n to the n. So I'm going to give a degree 1 in the ith spot. Okay? And so you just think of this as kind of this is analogous to a polynomial ring in several variables where each of the variables is a factor of MI. And so what I'm interested in here, so a couple of remarks, is that FM I can just look at this at the piece of this which has degrees less than or equal to 1 in each entry. Okay, so this includes kind of the stuff that's all zeros, that's the vacuum sector, and then all kind of all index vectors that are less than this one. And then I will declare or define FM of degree exactly this diagonal piece. This is the factorization homology with values in these biomodules. Okay, so just a couple of remarks about this. So not surprisingly, when X is a curve, when X is a curve, and the subschemes are just are just reduced points.
When dim x and the zi are just xi's points. This coincides, or the H0 of this, right? This is still a chain complex. So I can take H0 of this chain complex, and that's what I'm referring to here. This is exactly this. We recover the old space of covariance. So we have kind of a sort of a general propagation of vacua. Which will work in kind of in any dimension and really with any, you know, starting with any factorization algebra that's kind of somehow built out of this type of V algebra, which is, you know, regardless of what sort of other modules we have lying around, if you take a point and you put the Weyl module supported at a point and with the trivial representation, so this is the analog of the kind of point vacuum, then the space doesn't change. Yeah.
Maybe in the case of the complement of the subscheme is affine, you have a similar covariance formula?
I believe so. So I haven't, I mean, the, you know, the way you check that these things are equal is you write down a check complex where,
yeah.
And so, yeah, exactly. So it's just, so yes, I mean, I think if, you know, if you have a surface and you take a curve and, you know, it's ample and the complement is affine, then I think you'd have a very similar thing, right? Yeah, I think that's generic. I don't know, H naught. Doesn't change. Well, I mean, it's not just H naught. This whole thing doesn't change. I mean, this is, it becomes very stupid because all you're, I mean, if you write down what happens, you're just tensoring in a one-dimensional trivial representation into your, I mean, it's the tensor unit for this thing. So it's absolutely clear that the space of covariance doesn't change. What I really like about factorization algebras is that they somehow, at least these that are kind of constructed out of these local Lie algebras, they sort of come with God-given resolutions and Dobo resolutions. So calculations are very, very easy because you can just, everything can be filtered by symmetric degree, and then you run a very, very simple spectral sequence, and then everything kind of, if you're on something compact, and complex, then everything kind of collapses. So I mean, just as a kind of a toy example, as a very toy example, is the case of, you know, what if we start with the kind of abelian one-dimensional Lie algebra? So this corresponds at the affine algebra level, this corresponds to the Heisenberg algebra and Heisenberg vertex algebra. And you can play this game in any dimension. And so, for instance, in Frankl-Binz V, I think in chapter 12, you know, there's a calculation of what happens if you take P1 and you kind of you use these Weyl modules. So I should say, okay, so what's a if this is my finite dimensional Lie algebra, then I can start with I can represent, well, what's a representation of C? Well, I mean, the easiest thing you can do is just take C itself, but if you really want to go crazy and spice things up, you can have C act by multiplication by lambda rather than taking the trivial representation, right? And so then these, you have these kind of vowel modules that you can put at points, and there's a calculation there of the space of covariance. And so what's shown in the book is that you know, C, let me write this as the covariance of Heisenberg on P1 with x1 through xn. The answer here is that this is a one-dimensional space if these weights add up to zero and zero otherwise. Okay, and unless I was playing with this shortly before, but unless I did something very stupid, the claim is that from this perspective, this is true for any compact Kähler X and point modules. So in anything, so in particular anything that's smooth and projective, this will still be true, okay? Because this is somehow independent. I mean, these calculations turn out to be largely independent of the geometry in some sense, because after the first page of the spectral sequence, you're just doing a Lie algebra homology calculation. And in this particular case, there's not much information coming from that kind of higher cohomology to start with. So anyway, we are thinking about other aspects of the story. For instance, it would be nice to show that at least in some cases, these spaces of covariance or conformal blocks, if you will, carry some kind of connection over configuration space, or more generally perhaps over some moduli space and so on. I don't have anything concrete to report on this yet. But anyway, thanks.
Questions for Matt?
You can also look at stratified, like if I had a curve, you don't have to put a module there, you could put a different Casimir there.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it considered that too?
We haven't yet, but it's in the works, so to speak. Yeah. So of course in the topological world in the kind of EN version there is a well developed such a theory, but in the kind of holomorphic realm it's maybe less so. So yeah.
More questions? Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Matt again.